So it's December 22nd, 2018, the full moon, the Wan Prat, the monk day, a lunar observance day. And so the lay people come and take the refuges and precepts on this day. And from time to time, it's good to be reminded of why we do this and some of the history of the Lunar Observance Day. So I can at least start with that. And also, I can say that for anyone who may not be familiar with the taking of the eight precepts on the Lunar Observance Day, it's just a one-day determination of the precepts, so you're not binding yourself longer than today. And in Thailand, how this tradition works is that in the Northeast, anyway, and in rural Thailand, and it's changing now with modernization, but the weekend of the farmers and the villagers was structured around the Wan Prat. So it wasn't always, the weekend wasn't Saturday, Sunday, but it's the Wan Prat and the day after Wan Prat. So the villagers would actually come in the morning and take the eight precepts in the morning time, offer the meal, practice sitting and walking meditation through the day, then listen to Dhamma talk or Dhamma talks in the evening, and then meditate with the Sangha through the night. And so for example, the sixth precept, the refraining from eating at the inappropriate time, that's the villagers determining to eat the one meal a day, just like the monks for that day. So, in a sense, when we do this in America at Abayagiri, we determine things like the sixth precept, just eating only at the appropriate times, not at the inappropriate times. Then we're retroactively determining that, so we're assuming that we didn't have dinner today. Or maybe we did, but you can determine that and not have anything to eat for the rest of the evening. And so some of the history of why we follow the Lunar Observance Day in the time of the Buddha was reflecting that it'd be nice to follow some of the lunar quarters like the Brahmins do in order to give some more structure and coherence to the Sangha life that was starting to build up around him. And so, fairly early on in the Buddha's dispensation, then he decided, okay, well, the new moon and full moon days, which are the days that the monks recite the Patimokkha, the rules of training, then we could have something where the monks meditate through the night. And wouldn't it be nice if the lay people could take on certain practices and precepts that some of the behaviors of arhats, of fully enlightened beings, just for a day and a night? And wouldn't that be beautiful? So the Buddha's reflecting, well, what are some things that arhats can't do? And then that's how the eight precepts came about. So the Buddha having the lay people act like arhats for a day and a night with the eight precepts. So, according to our Pali canon, anyway, the arhat can't intentionally take life. Arhat can't intentionally take that which isn't given. The arhat can't engage in any kind of sexual activity. The arhat can't use false or harmful speech. The arhat wouldn't engage in the taking of any type of intoxicants, eat at the wrong time, engage in entertainment, beautification, or adornment, and they would always sleep in a low, humble place, usually just spreading a mat on the ground, and would refrain from using high and luxurious seats in sleeping places. So then it began the tradition of the wanpara, the lay people coming together and then determining these precepts and then staying with the Sangha. But then somebody complained to the Buddha and they said, and this is the exact words from the scriptures, that all the monks do is sit there all night like dumb pigs. So then the tradition built up of giving Dhamma talks on the wanpara, and then also the monks would discuss Dhamma with each other through the night sometimes. So this was a practice that Lungpur Cha really took on. And I think in the time of the Buddha, it would have been just on the new moon and the full moon, and possibly the quarter moons were observed somehow. But with Lungpur Cha coming up with his way of practice at Wat Pa Pong, then following the lunar observance day on the roughly once a week, so it's on the new moon, full moon, and the lunar quarters as well, the half moons. So the way that works, it's not always the same, but it's roughly once a week. So the progression, the way it goes, is like 8 days, 7 days, 8 days, 7 days, 8 days, 7 days, 8 days, 6 days. So once every 2 months. So it's like a 15-day, what we call a fortnight, but then every 2 months there's a 14-day Upasita observance. So then what that becomes is it's like Monday, Monday, Tuesday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Thursday, Friday, Friday, Saturday, Friday. So something like that. That's how the progression goes, and then it starts over again. So the tradition, the lay people would come and meditate with the Sangha, and so I thought I had an idea that the next part of this could give a little bit of a guided meditation, because in order to come to the monastery and learn about meditation, it's not always about just meditating on the breath or just meditating on Bhutto, but like Lungpur Ban told us when we went to visit him, he said when you practice you actually have to think a lot, and you have to think a lot, but you have to think about the right things. So with could make this partially a talk, partially a guided meditation. And one of the aims, or really the aim of meditation, it's not, we're not trying to have a certain type of really deep experience. And maybe like a deep experience will happen, but when we meditate, we want to just be at ease. That's the whole point, is to learn how to just be at ease and have a sense of contentment. Then wherever the mind wants to go from there, it'll go naturally according to our paramis, according to how much we've practiced in the past. And sometimes that can happen through we sit and we focus on the process of our breathing in order to, that's like the anchor, that's the beginning of the meditation. So it's like the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha says, sitting upright, mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out, not trying to control the breath in any way. And when we breathe in long, we know that it's a long breath. And when we breathe out long, we know it's a long breath. When we breathe in short, we know it's a short breath. And when we breathe out short, we know that it's a short breath. And a way that Ajahn Chah would teach this also and would be to focus on the tip of the nose, the sensation of the air entering the nose. And that's a cooler sensation. And then when we breathe out, noticing a warmer sensation as the air exits the nose. And then the third step of Anapanasati is breathing in. I experience the whole body. And breathing out, I experience the whole body. Breathing in, calming the whole body. And breathing out, calming the whole body. So meditation, it's a training in how we move our attention around. If our attention is on a wholesome object like the breath, we don't necessarily need to zoom in completely at the tip of the nose. But we can start there, that's our starting point. But then as we start to feel a bit more at ease, then we can be free to move our attention into focusing on what's the state of the body right now. Is there tension? That's experiencing the whole body. So is there tension in the eyes? Is there tension in the face? Is there tension in the chest? Or is there tension anywhere in the body? Then calming the whole body, if there's tension in the eyes, consciously calming the eyes. If there's tension in the face, consciously calming the face. And so on. And so once we feel a sense of ease, we can either go deeper into that sense of ease, or we can do an analytical meditation, which is what we'll do here. And this will be a meditation on goodwill, metta. And the way we do this meditation is we actually think during the meditation, but we're using right thought in the Noble Eightfold Path. Because we're acknowledging that the Buddha never said no thought, that's not a factor of the Eightfold Path. There's no path factor that says no thought, but there is right thought. So it's learning how to use our thoughts skillfully. And one of the factors of right thought is goodwill. So we can use this opportunity to cultivate one part of right thought. And one of the ways the Buddha recommended to do that is to recollect our own virtue, So this is goodwill for oneself. It's so easy to focus in on our foibles and our quirks and our ways we criticize ourselves, maybe ways others have criticized us. But chances are, if we're already practicing Dhamma, the things we've done which are worthy of criticism are probably far less than things we've done that are praiseworthy. So we can just set the critical thinking, the criticisms aside, and then just consciously bring up perhaps a time when we did something for somebody else, or we gave a gift and we felt good about it. It could be a time when we came to the monastery and offered a meal. Or where we went out of our way and worked really hard to give something to somebody or to the monastery. And so this is recollecting our own virtue. It's not becoming really egotistical about it or putting ourselves higher than anybody else, but it's just giving rise to a really wholesome sense of self-confidence and pride in our own good actions. And we can try to think of something that we have done in the past where we may have done something really helpful for somebody, but nobody ever knew, and we never told anybody about it, but we just did it anyway. And so, in doing that, we cultivated humility, and we have that aspect of being humble. So that's something worth feeling good about. Or we may have given time or attention to somebody who was suffering, and we were able to just listen to them. And this is something which we can do for people who are dying as well. So like in Thailand, I know this is something that Ajahn Jayasura recommended. There was a woman who had supported the Sangha for a long time, and she was having somewhat of a difficult death and was not conscious, but somehow suffering, struggling. Heart rate was going faster and faster, and then he had recommended that her relatives remind her of some of the merits she had made during her life and supporting the monasteries. So they would whisper to her, "Well, remember that time we went to that really remote monastery and offered a meal to these monks and offered them requisites? They had almost nothing, and they were so happy to be supported, and we made them those meals. And it was so difficult to get out there." And then sure enough, they said this to her and the heart rate went down and you could see like a little smile. And so this is what we're aiming for. This is the kind of thing we're wanting to bring up for ourselves, to raise the mental state out of the kind of shadowy mire we might be wallowing in. And then we can think of goodwill for somebody who's dear to us, so we can think, consciously bring up somebody who may have helped us or we have gratitude for. A lot of people in this step will think of their mother. But it can also be a dear friend or somebody who's been especially kind to us. And then to think of something specific that they may have done. Maybe they praised us when we were not doing well, or gave us some words of encouragement and helped us to get out of whatever rut we were in. And so this is like consciously beaming thoughts of goodwill at that person, at someone who's dear to us. Then after that, we go on to the person we're indifferent towards. So we might think of just somebody we walked by on the street or saw in the supermarket. What we'd like to do with this practice is to take that same feeling of goodwill and then have that same feeling while thinking of someone who we're indifferent towards, who we don't know. And bringing up thoughts that their life is every much as complicated and variegated as our own lives. And they have their happiness and suffering of being another human being in the world. So may they be well, may they be happy. That's just an example of some of the thoughts you might bring up during a goodwill meditation or a metta meditation. And I won't bring in the next part of the meditation. We can do that on our own if we feel like we're ready for it, in terms of beaming goodwill at those who might wish us harm. So I won't even go into that, because that's really difficult to do. But I can talk about a little bit about mudita as well. So the third of the Brahmaviharas. And before that, actually, just to talk about right thought, that the Buddha said right thought in the Noble Eightfold Path. It's threefold, so it's thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-harming. So thoughts of renunciation, that's specifically thoughts of non-sensuality, so not trying to proliferate or get our happiness from sensuality, but trying to find more of an internal stable happiness. Thoughts of non-ill will, that can be equated with metta, or thoughts of goodwill. Thoughts of non-harming can be equated with karuna, compassion. So renunciation, loving-kindness, compassion. That would be right thought, the Noble Eightfold Path. So when we practice, what we want to do is try to raise our consciousness or raise our mental state so it's not the normal, subtly negative mental state that we can default to just living in the world or in the monastery or anywhere. And we don't want to just act like we're happy. Like, we don't want it to be fake. We don't want it to be superficial or some sort of Pollyanna-ish happiness. So we don't want to just try to tell ourselves I'm happy and then act like we're happy when we're not. But we can use some of these Buddhist reflections and some of the teachings in order to uplift the mind, gladden the mind. Because if we don't gladden the mind, then we're always just going to be dragging our feet and kind of having a rough time. So this the teachings on mudita, which the translation I like is rejoicing. It's also, in some places you'll see it as sympathetic joy. But I like the feeling of the word rejoicing. And this is a specific antidote to two mental states. There's two mental states which can be really insidious and really hard to acknowledge that we have. One is jealousy, the other is envy. So these are two ways the defilements can do harm to us. So, like, for example, if we see somebody who is better than us at something, so for example, if we're working in the kitchen and like there's somebody in the kitchen who's just really, really good at working in the kitchen and we just feel really inadequate when we're around them. So they're a really great cook, they're really organized, they're good at everything in the kitchen. Then we might feel like I'm really inadequate. I can't even measure up to how good this person is in the kitchen, how good of a cook they are, how organized they are. And I don't even want to work with them in the kitchen because they're so good, I can't even bear to be around them. So this is a real life example. This has actually happened here. I had somebody request to me that they not work in the kitchen, not because of any conflict, but because the other person in the kitchen was so good, they couldn't work in there. Because it was just, they weren't measuring up to this other person in the kitchen. So, yeah, that's fine. But the way to deal with those kind of mental states is then to use mudita. So instead of getting hard on ourselves or feeling inadequate, or envious of this person that they're so good, then say, well, that's great. That's good for them that they have that particular skill, that they've cultivated this, that they're so good at this. And start to flip the mental state around into rejoicing in the skill that that person has or the talent that that person has. Or it could happen in the monastery, like, this person's a better meditator than me. Like, I can feel, if I'm completely honest with myself, I can feel like, okay, that's a sense of jealousy. Like, I feel really inadequate because this person, this other monk, is a better meditator than me. So like, okay, well, I've been here for so many years and still this person's better meditator than me. You know, I'm never going to be able to do it. So it kind of, the mind can go negative, it can go down that route. Or it can go down the mudita route, down the rejoicing route. Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful that they're a better meditator, that they're actually doing what they came here to do. They're succeeding. That's wonderful. And it's kind of a subtle shift, but just flipping it around in that way it just makes a world of difference in our experience here. And it's also said in some teachings in the Tibetan tradition I was reading, but I can really see that it's true, is that when you rejoice in somebody else's goodness, you get a share of their merit that they're making. So if you do this, you can really see that that's true. And then the mind gets much more positive, much more uplifted. And then if we do want to cultivate that virtue that, say, the other person has that we don't have yet, we're in a much better position to do that when the mind is gladdened and we have a strength there. That's so much better than getting into the state of like, well, I'm never going to have that. I'm never going to be that good. And kind of just getting down on ourselves. Or somebody may have a talent that it's clear we'll never have, or some sort of ability that we know we'll never have. Say, like the Krubha Ajahns or Lumbar Cha or the Buddha. So have rejoicing in the Buddha. Thinking of the Buddha, rejoicing in the goodness of the Buddha. And then what that does is then it causes us to, it links back to metta as well, because then it causes us to think of the good qualities of others, and it goes against our critical mind because we're not thinking of their bad qualities. And so I was relating a sutta I'd read long time ago, kind of relating this at tea time, so I guess I'll just relate it here again. But it's attributed to Sariputta, and I think it's in the Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Fives, and it's Sariputta teaching the monks how to keep their minds positive, and that he says something like, "Monks, don't focus on the faults of others. Only focus on their good qualities." So if someone has only good qualities, it's easy. Just focus on their good qualities. If someone's just replete in good qualities, then reflect on their good qualities. You can feel good about that. If someone has, say, like three parts good qualities, one part bad qualities, reflect on the three parts of good qualities. If someone has half good qualities, half bad qualities, reflect on the good half. If somebody has only one part good qualities and three parts bad qualities, reflect on just that one part of good qualities. Don't let your mind go to the bad qualities. And then if somebody has almost only bad qualities and only a tiny amount of good qualities, but they do have some sort of good quality, but it's mostly bad, then just as a person, just as a thirsty person would see water in a hoof print from a cow, then they might cup their hands carefully and put their hands in the water and get some clean water into their hands in that muddy footprint, and they might drink a little bit of clean water from there. Just so if someone has very few good qualities and mostly bad qualities, you should still focus on those very few good qualities and make much of them. And then he goes on to say, if someone has no good qualities at all, then don't associate with them. But that's rare. Most people are going to have at least a few good qualities that we can hone in on and focus on. So also on the one pra, it's good to give encouragement in terms of striving or meditation. It's also the time of year when people get sick. So like Ajahn Kurudamo is not here this evening because he's coming down with some sort of cold or flu or something. So he's gone to take a rest this evening. But this is the day that we normally stay up and do some striving in our meditation, but we also have to look after ourselves if we're coming down with something, if we're sick. So it's fun to think back to the past and early days at Abhayagiri, with Ajahn Amaro, Ajahn Pasano leading the charge, and Abhayagiri first opened. Could say that Ajahn Pasano and Ajahn Amaro were pretty gung-ho with how hard they were practicing and leading the community, leading the charge. And they were following the old Wat Pa Phong style of just staying up all night on the wanpra. So the old Wat Pa Phong style is to stay up all night, and then the next day is just a normal day. So you have a work period, etc. So, in the time of Lungpor Cha, that's how they were doing it. Lungpor Cha was leading the charge, and you had these really tough Wat Pa Phong monks practicing really hard all the time. So, started out with that, and people were trying really hard. The community was quite small, but I wasn't here yet until year number five. So, but some of the stories I've heard previous to that was they'd stay up all night, have the work period the next day, but then things started happening during the work period. So, like people were using power tools when they were really tired, and it was getting, there were some close calls. It wasn't safe. So first they said, okay, we'll still stay up all night and have a normal day the next day, but no power tools, no using power tools. Then a very tired Anagarika drove the truck off the road, having fallen asleep at the wheel. And so then they said, okay, no work period. Day after Wanpra. So then, already by the time I had come, it had morphed into, okay, chanting at 3 a.m., 3:30, optional. You can either stay up all night or you can go back, take a rest, and then it's a rest day the next day. So also, early days at Wat Pa Nanachat, they were doing the hardcore Wanpra all night practice, and this still does happen at Wat Nanachat, but then they had robe washing day on the day after Wanpra. So that was like the weekly, you boil up the jackfruit dye and we wash our robes in the dye. So day after Wanpra, boil up the dye, do robe washing, whole community's there. There's usually anywhere from 10 to 20 monks. And then it started happening that it wasn't working because there was just too many conflicts and disharmony, arguments erupting during the robe washing because everybody's really, really tired. So then they changed it to robe washing being the day before Wanprat. So it's difficult. This is a difficult practice that Lungpor Cha set up. in the very early days of Wat Bapong, even before Ajahn Sumedho got there. So when they had this one prayer, they did have like a midnight break, and back then it was so much different than now. Like back then it was, there was a, it was still allowed to smoke at Wat Bapong. So there was a tray of like roll cigarettes that would go around, and a tray of betel nut. So those would go around to the Sangha, and according to the stories, the whole Dhamma hall would fill with smoke. And of course that changed when they started realizing, Westerners started coming, oh, cigarettes are bad for you, okay. So Ajahn Shah had them stop. And now we have cheese and chocolate. So it's sort of changed into that. But still, it's a difficult practice, and we do have to go against this sense of tiredness. Like for myself, usually I crash around 11 p.m. And then if I awake after 11 p.m., I might as well stay up all night, because it's not going to make much difference when I go to sleep. But it's a struggle, so sometimes it's hard to stay awake. We're nodding, and we get really tired. And I remember really struggling with this when I was in Anagarika. So really, really wanting to stay up all night, really wanting to do the practice, but then finding it's so difficult. And in the old Dhamma hall, we used to sit so that the wall was on our right side. And I remember it was 2 a.m, and a number of us were in there, and I fell asleep, and my head slammed into the wall, and then there was this really loud, like, thump, and then I was really embarrassed, and I woke up, and I looked around, and almost everybody was asleep. Actually, nobody heard me, and so everybody's head was just completely down. But everybody's in there, so it's, even if you fall asleep, you're sitting up, so it's that sense of like you're developing patient endurance, you're developing certain qualities that, even if you fall asleep, it's these spiritual qualities that we need to kind of get ourselves, one, to be able to see suffering, two, to just like get ourselves through this life, because we do take on, it's amazing that we even have a place like this, a monastery, where we have enough faith that what the Buddha said is true, so we're willing to take on all these precepts, all these practices, and actually do them as a community, and actually have it sustain itself over the years, over the decades. Another one of the benefits of the Wanpra is when we push ourselves, there's a sense of camaraderie that builds up, so that shared difficulty, shared suffering. It's a really important part of the community. It builds up a sense of being like a Dhamma family. So it's not really like friends, but it is like family. It's like the monks you live with really are like brothers. And then the people who come to look after you really are like in the Isan, we call them pa'ok me'ok, which is like literally means like outside father, outside mother. So it's like they're coming to look, the lay people, all of you coming to look after us. So that's like a sense of family as well. Yeah, it's just, I don't know exactly where I'm going with this, but it's just reflecting on how amazing it is that the Buddha set these things up, and that we had Lungpor Cha in Thailand upholding these types of practices, and it's just for our long-term benefit, so it's so good to kind of make use of these opportunities. And I know even people who aren't here will follow the Wanpra observance on their own. So, like, remember one gentleman who's been a friend of ours for a long time and ended up moving away, but he would follow the Wanpra on his own. And so he would stay up, listen to a Dhamma talk, actually meditate in his house till midnight, and then actually have allowables on his own just because it reminded him of being here and he felt like he was here. And he did that for years. And that was just his practice. He was retired. That's just what he did. And it kept him in the Dhamma, kept him in the loop. So having these regular times, it also helps us to build up consistency in our practice. You know, or if we've been losing the plot or something's gone wrong during the week, we can always use the Wanpra to lift ourselves back up, start over again. So I guess I'll leave it there. It's just a few thoughts about meditation, goodwill, metta meditation, or how to do the analytical meditation, and then mudita, rejoicing, and then some of the history and the benefits of the eight precepts and the Wanpra observance. So I'll leave it there for this evening. So anybody who likes can stay up and practice with us. We'll have tea and allowables at midnight and morning chanting at 3. But I encourage you, if you are getting sick, to take a rest. Rest is probably the best thing if you're coming down with something.